several seats available up throughout the room, so feel free to come on up and find a seat. And if folks on the aisles want to squeeze in to fill it in and make it easy, that's cool too. All right, so today we're here to talk about Exchange Server 2013 tips and tricks. And we'll have a pretty full session, and see Mario's bringing up some Exchange posters. So for those of you who haven't had a chance to get an Exchange poster, this is one of your last chances to get one printed. This is the last chance. This is it. This is all we have. Now, of course, it is a downloadable PDF, and anybody can take it to any copy center that they want and print their own 36 by 24 poster. But these are here, and so if you've already gotten one, please don't try to get one today. If you haven't gotten one, I can't guarantee you one, but we'll see what we can do for you. So how many of you have been to one of my tips and tricks sessions before? All right, a few of you. How many of you have maybe seen a recording or heard about it? Not too many. So the fact that most of you have not seen one and have not watched a recording but are still here, I think is fantastic. So thank you for coming. If you haven't seen one of these, basically what I typically do is I try to make them new and different for each presentation. And I try to come up with things that are either not so well documented or not so well understood yet, or things that you need to be aware of, or general basic level setting information and so forth. And we typically sort of ramp up. We'll start out with some basic information, and then we'll move forward to some more interesting areas like transport, public folders, managed availability, compliance, some OWA stuff that we've done, and a few other places as well. So let's just start with the basics so everybody understands exactly what Exchange 2013 is and the additions and the features and things like that. So I know we've been RTM for a while now, but I do like to sort of list the milestones for the product that we've gone to. We actually RTM'd last year, just about a month after TechEd Australia last year. And as I mentioned in several sessions, it was TechEd Australia, and then later on TechEd New Zealand, where we first introduced Exchange 2013 in public presentations. Since then, we've had a couple releases. We released Cumulative Update 1, and more recently, we've released and then re-released Cumulative Update 2 for Exchange 2013. FYI, on our nomenclature for cumulative updates, the CUs that we've released are for Exchange 2013 RTM. So when you see them referred to as Exchange 2013 RTM CU1, that is the full name of the cumulative update. So that's how we distinguish them from, for example, Exchange 2013 Service Pack 1, CU1, and so forth. Okay, so these are our milestones, and of course, we'll continue to release cumulative updates, and I'll have a little bit more to say about that in a bit. Now, Exchange 2013, like Exchange 2010, is available in three editions. There's two editions that you'll use for production user use. Those would be the standard and enterprise edition. There is only one single difference between those two editions, and that is the support for the number of databases that they can have. Standard is limited to 5 mounted databases. That can be active or passive. And enterprise, starting with CU2, is limited to 100 databases per server. In RTM CU1, we only had 50 databases per server, and we did some work and some extra validation to introduce support for 100 databases in CU2. And for those of you who may have already gone through an exercise in sizing a deployment in RTM and CU1, if you redo that deployment with CU2 in the mind, that should reduce your server count because you can host more databases on it. Now, there's a third edition of Exchange that we introduced with Exchange 2010, and that is called the Hybrid Edition. The Hybrid Edition is there to, as its name implies, provide you with a server that can be a sort of a hybrid gateway or a go-between, an on-premises Exchange deployment and a cloud-based Office 365 deployment. The Hybrid Edition you actually get for free, but of course you do have to be an Office 365 subscriber. So if you're a trial customer, you'll simply use the trial version of Exchange 2013 without a license key for your hybrid connectivity needs. Once you purchase Office 365, then you contact their support and they will send you the free key that will turn that server into a Hybrid Edition server for you. The thing to be aware of with the Hybrid Edition server is, yes, it's just like an Exchange server. It basically mirrors the functionality of Exchange 2013 standard. And what that means, though, is it might be tempting to put other functionality outside the scope of the hybrid connection on that server. If you do that, though, you're actually outside the terms of the license agreement for the hybrid server. So you can't do anything like put mailboxes on it or public folders or anything else that is outside the scope of what its limited function is in terms of that hybrid connection. So just keep that in mind. If you do need that server for other functions, you can use them, but you'll have to actually buy a regular license for that. Now, when we talk about the number of databases, we're only talking about mounted databases, and we're only talking about active and passive databases. So recovery databases do not count against the limits that I mentioned earlier. And again, mounted could be active or passive. Active databases get mounted and attached to the store for user activity, and passive databases get mounted and attached to the replication service for replication and replay purposes. Now, the hybrid edition for Exchange 2013 is actually not needed if you're in a native Exchange 2013 organization. Exchange 2013 itself has these built-in native hybrid capabilities, so it doesn't need a separate hybrid server. So the Exchange 2013 hybrid server is really just there for Exchange 2007 and Exchange 2010 customers who want to go ahead and have a hybrid relationship with Office 365 running Wave 15. So keep that in mind. That's all it's there for. And if you're an Exchange 2003 customer, no, you cannot move directly to Exchange 2013, but we do have a mechanism by using an Exchange 2010 hybrid server where you can use that to connect to the cloud. And of course, once you're into the cloud, you can decommission 2003, and then if you want, introduce a hybrid environment and maybe move some of your mailboxes back to an on-premises Exchange 2013 server. Now, cumulative updates. How many of you are familiar with our servicing strategy for Exchange 2013? A few of you, okay. So we've done away with what we used to call roll-up updates. Now what we deliver on roughly a quarterly basis, although that may change, are what we call cumulative updates. So cumulative updates are packaged updates with the latest code, and there are some pretty significant differences between CU's cumulative updates and RU's, the roll-up updates we used to have. But we do have a new servicing process that we use with these CU updates. So as an example, before we deploy a CU update, or before we ship it to the download center for you to deploy it, we'll actually go ahead and deploy it in our own dog food environment, we'll deploy it in Office 365, and we'll try to validate every possible scenario before we ship it to you. Now, for those of you who've been keeping close track on our progress on doing that, you know that we've had a few hiccups along the way. There have been some CUs that have been released that we've had to recall because we found some issues around data loss and other bugs around them. And even though these have gone through the process I just described, where we deployed them in the cloud first and validated them in test and dog food, some things, as we found, can still slip by. So we're still working on perfecting that process. This is a relatively new servicing model for us, so there are bound to be some glitches in it. And we do welcome your feedback on that as well. So if any of you have been inconvenienced by some of the hiccups that we've gone through, I want to apologize for that because it's we don't feel very good about that either. So we are working hard to sort of fill in the gaps that are present in our validation process, and that should improve quality. Of course, only time will tell on that. The security updates, though, we have agreed to deliver separate security updates. So if there is a specific security fix that we need you to have, we will not force you to go to a particular CU to get it. So as long as the cumulative update that you're running is still supported, we will release security updates for that cumulative update. So there are some benefits. One of the original benefits we hoped for was that you'd have a predictable release cadence, that you would have a pretty good idea as to when the CUs would be released. And typically what we started seeing was we would release them once a quarter. And of course, a quarter is a three-month period, and that mistakenly led some to believe that we were going to ship every 3 months. And that's not the case. We could ship on the first day of Q1 and then ship on the last day of Q2, which is roughly almost a six-month time gap. So we do hope to deliver them quarterly. But given the recent incidents we've had with pretty bad bugs slipping through and our need to constantly recall these updates to get it right and ship it to you, we may adjust that schedule to give ourselves a bit more time just to really thoroughly go through everything a little bit more extra and ship a higher quality product to you. So right now we're still saying every quarter roughly, but again, that could change and maybe break out a little farther. There are some differences between the cumulative updates and roll-up updates. Remember, the roll-up updates are the smaller packages because they only contain the DLLs and other binaries that actually have been changed by those updates. A cumulative update is much more like a service pack. It is the entire product. So you don't have to deploy Exchange RTM and then put a cumulative update on top of it. You can just download the latest cumulative update, and that is the full version. It can be used to do a fresh install of Exchange, or it can be used to upgrade an existing install of Exchange. So it's just like a service pack. And in fact, just like a service pack, it's very large. And just like a service pack, as Setup actually does its deployment, its actual process is uninstalling the existing product and installing the new product in its place. And that's different from, say, like slipstreaming or patching or things like that, because the uninstall process also removes some customizations you may have done to the system. Perhaps you've customized a web.config file, for example. Those things will be removed as part of the CU update and replaced with our code. So if you do make updates to web.config and some other places, you'll need to recreate those settings after you've applied the CU. So it is kind of a pain, but it is pretty much the same experience that we have with Exchange Service Packs historically. So hopefully most of you are used to doing that as well. There is also a specific recovery process. If you're installing a CU and it fails for some reason, you can try to restart Setup and maybe it might recover, but if you can't get Setup to recover, your only backoff plan is to actually wipe the server and then run Setup Recover Server using the original bits that were on the box. So if you were going from CU1 to CU2, you would run Recover Server with the CU1 bits because that's what you had installed. And then by popular customer demand, unlike what we did with roll-up updates, with cumulative updates, when you do install them, we will increment the server version build number. So inside EAC, inside PowerShell, when you do get Exchange version, you will be able to see exactly the build number, and you will be able to correlate that with a specific CU. You can go to that blog post to find out more about the servicing model as well. It is a few months old because it describes it when we first announced it. And as I mentioned, we are in the process of evaluating whether or not it needs adjustment based on quality. All right, let's talk about some general stuff. I'm not going to drill down on everything in this slide, but I did want to list out a bunch of things that are actually gone in Exchange 2013, because we talk about it as an upgrade to previous versions and how it is the nth version and a legacy of Exchange servers. But the reality is actually this. Exchange 2010, from my personal feeling, this is not Microsoft or Exchange talking, this is my personal take on Exchange 2010, was it was the last version in that era, and that Exchange 2013 starts a whole new era and a whole new paradigm with a new architecture and lots of new code and functionality in it. And the reason I say that is because of the sheer number of things that are simply gone, or the sheer number of things that we've physically removed from the code that simply don't exist anymore. So some of those things are gone in logical respect, like the legacy hub transport and the legacy CAS and the legacy UM roles. They're gone logically. Physically, they still exist, but that functionality is now inside the mailbox role. But logically, those server roles don't exist anymore. What else is gone? The Exchange Management Console. No more MMC snap-ins, that's gone. And the Exchange Control Panel that we introduced in Exchange 2010 is also gone, but don't worry about that. There's a replacement that I'll talk about in a minute. I mentioned RPC over TCP connectivity for Outlook clients, gone, no longer supported. All Outlook clients must now use Outlook Anywhere to connect to Exchange 2013, also known as RPC over HTTP. It is still MAPI traffic, it's RPC MAPI traffic, it's just encapsulated in HTTP instead of being sent over RPC TCP. Support for Outlook 2003 is gone. That should not be a surprise. We typically only support the latest client minus two, so Outlook 2013, 2010, and 2007 with specific updates are needed. The legacy information store, store.exe, this has been in there since Exchange 4.0. It is gone. It is completely gone. Does not exist anymore. And the legacy database caching algorithm, the dynamic buffer algorithm where the store would consume all available memory, is also gone. And I'll talk about its replacement as well. Microsoft Search, which we started using several versions of Exchange ago and continued up until Exchange 2010, is gone and completely replaced with brand new search technology. Public folder databases are gone, along with their public folder replication mechanism. So again, you can start to see the staggering number of things. Some other things, this is called Legacy Outlook Web App, but what I really mean here is the version of Outlook Web App that we introduced in Exchange 2010 after we threw away the one that we wrote brand new in Exchange 2007. So 2007, 2010, and now 2013 all have brand new unique versions of Outlook Web App. So we keep throwing it away and rewriting it. We might have to look into an addiction problem there. The virus scanning API, also gone. That was the last third-party hook into the information store. That is now gone. And along with it, all third-party access directly into the store is gone. There are no public APIs that allow any third-party applications to get into the store anymore. Managed folders are gone. The ability to remove individual server roles is gone. That really shouldn't be a big deal because there's only two, and we strongly recommend multi-role. So ideally, you won't be removing individual server roles. But there is a process. If you actually do want to split out a multi-role box, you simply uninstall Exchange, and then you install just the role you want on there. It's not a big deal. So what's new? A lot of things are new. So many new things. A whole new server architecture. That's all brand new. And actually, I just want to pause for a bit because I see so many people standing in the doorway. There's seats in here if you want to come in and have a seat. Please feel welcome to join us. In fact, if you wouldn't mind raising your hand if you have an empty seat next to you so people can see where they are. So the server role architectures, all brand new. The client access server is brand new. It does have the same name, but it is a brand new server. The legacy client access server that you know and have worked with now exists only in the mailbox role. And this is a new lightweight thin protocol proxy that we've introduced. The managed store that replaces the information store. This is our new information store, which uses a worker process model to give you greater hardware efficiency and failure isolation. Not to mention a static database caching algorithm, which literally saved us hundreds and hundreds of thousands of lines of code. Managed availability is also brand new. That is high availability that is now extended to all the rest of Exchange, all the protocols, all the client functionality, all the components, all the features, et cetera. Search Foundation replaces Microsoft Search, so we do have more robust search technology in there. Does come with a little bit more CPU and memory requirements, but the throughput and the content indexing performance you get, not to mention the stability that you'll get out of it, is well worth that trade-off. And in fact, it's also been standardized across Office, so we use it not just in Exchange now, but also in SharePoint as well. Let's see, the Exchange Admin Center, that is the web-based console that replaces both the Exchange Management Console and the Exchange Control Panel. So now you just have one graphical UI that you work with, the Exchange Admin Center, and then of course, you still have Remote PowerShell for your console-based UI as well. Outlook Web App is brand new, along with apps in Outlook Web App. In fact, we ship with apps in the box, things like Bing Maps and Suggested Actions, and there's other apps that administrators can get from the Office Store and download it, integrate and distribute through Exchange and through Outlook Web App and through Outlook 2013 as well. There's LinkedIn integration, contact linking, multi-calendar views. It's all been redesigned for touch as well, and I'll show you some tips later on how you can manipulate the view based on the touch screen or the form factor that you're using. Data loss prevention is also new. We had a similar feature in the form of transport rules, but this now comes with policy templates and policy tips that get displayed to Outlook 2013. And of course, because this is the same code we run in the cloud, there's some extra features that you get if you're using a hybrid or a cloud-based deployment with DLP, such as reporting as well. Some other things, the unified contact store and the ability to archive link contacts shows you very tight link integration that we have now. Modern public folders replaces public folder databases with public folders that now use the mailbox architecture and the database availability group for high availability. So no more worrying about public folder replication or dealing with public folder replication storms. I'll take that. I didn't do it myself, but I'll take the credit for it. Thank you. More namespace options. We've given you greater site resilience configuration options, including now the ability to natively and seamlessly use a single worldwide namespace for your deployments, for your mail users. If you look at the high availability and site resilience session I did at last year's TechEd Australia or any of the ones in the TechEd subsequent to that, you'll see in the site resilience section I talk about this and demonstrate how a single namespace would work. And let's see, the only other thing worth calling out here maybe is workload management. That is in there, constantly looking at the resource utilization on the box and throttling back where necessary so that the user experience is not impacted by other activity that might be going on the box, background database maintenance, scheduled assistance, and those kinds of things. All right, and there's actually so much more new in here that we could spend all day talking about it. So go to that link and you'll find lots more information about all the goodness that we have in there for you. There's also some great ways to get connected as well. If you aren't using these resources, I would strongly encourage you to start bookmarking them and using them. For one thing, the Exchange Team blog is where we announce everything that's coming, all the new stuff. In fact, a lot of the stuff that we're doing that comes into TechNet goes first to the blog so that we can quickly publish and get the information out to you. So definitely check out our blog. We've also got forums on TechNet for IT pros and developers, an RSS feed for support knowledge base articles, so you don't have to go trolling through the knowledge base yourself. You can just pull down that list. And then there's also third-party forums to get you connected as well. I would strongly recommend that you get into the ecosystem and get into the community and make yourself a part of it, because it's very thriving and dynamic and just filled with all sorts of great people and great information. There's also other forums to go to as well, and there's some important downloads you're going to want to go get. In addition to TechNet, we also still produce a compiled HTML help file, so you can go and download our latest documentation in a help file, which is awesome because it's so much easier to search that help file in a compiled HTML help than it is on TechNet, because you can just get a finite list of content and not search all of TechNet. Plus, you can print from it, and obviously you can use it offline. Although we do have a feature in TechNet called TechNet Print-A-Book that allows you to select a bunch of topics and create your own offline PDF out of them as well. There's also the poster. You can download this poster from that URL as well and print it yourself or just use it as a desktop wallpaper or whatever. DLP policy templates, we've included more of those. And we also do support the ability to download and install third-party DLP policy templates as well. So a policy template would be something designed to catch sensitive information that you wouldn't want leaked through the email system. So that would be a policy template related to something like personally identifiable information, credit cards, passports, driver's license, traveler information, et cetera, et cetera. Basically anything that could personally or uniquely identify a person, possibly lead to identity theft and things like that. Office Visio stencils, if you want to use some of the same shapes I used to create that poster, you can download those and use them in Visio. They're a wonderful way to do that. The UN language packs, we have those downloadable separately now to make it easier for you to deploy them. And the cumulative update strategy that we have also allows us to do language updates faster as well. And then for those of you doing programmatic EWS applications, the EWS managed API will be a necessary download for you as well. All right, let's talk about PowerShell now. PowerShell has changed quite a bit, not in terms of our implementation of it, but in terms of the commandlets and the functionality that's available to you. Now, most of the things that are now gone from PowerShell refer to features that are gone too. So obviously something like the RPC client access object. We don't use that anymore. We don't need to, because that object was there only for internally domain-joined Outlook clients that were connecting via RPC over TCP. We don't allow connectivity over RPC over TCP anymore, so we don't need that object. Because we don't need the object, we've removed the PowerShell commands that manipulate that object. What that means is if you're in a coexistence environment with Exchange 2010 and Exchange 2013, if you do need to manipulate the object for 2010 purposes, you will need to go and use the 2010 PowerShell to do that, because 2013 simply doesn't have that commandlet anymore. Other things like the routing group connectors, the team mailboxes, those are also features that are simply gone, so the commandlets that were there to interface with them are also gone as well. Now, get logon statistics, there's a little asterisk there. This is kind of an unusual one, and it's one of a few that sort of fall into the same category. We do have several commandlets in Exchange 2013 that have been what we call deprecated. So the difference between cut and deprecated is cut means it's actually physically gone. Deprecated means one of two things. Deprecated means either it's still in the existing product, but it's going away in the next version, or it's still in the existing product, but you shouldn't use it because it's non-functional or it doesn't work the way it used to. The get log on statistics falls into that second category. It's still in the product, you can still run it, but it's not going to do anything for you. We will eventually remove it, but one of the reasons we haven't is we have gotten a lot of feedback from customers and MVPs and other folks that say, I really like the information that that commandlet provides. What sort of replacement can you give me for that? And we're still sort of working out the scenarios in which customers actually find that commandlet useful, because we use it in the cloud, or we used it in the cloud for Exchange 2010, but it really didn't provide us with meaningful information from a troubleshooting or performance or capacity planning standpoint. So that's one of the reasons we began the process of deprecating it. If you are using this commandlet today and you do have a business case for using it, send that to me and I'll send it to the PM who owns this commandlet, and we'll see how we can work that in and figure out what the plan will be for that. Some things that are new, there's actually too many things to list that are new. We literally increased about 50% more commandlets in Exchange 2013 than we had in Exchange 2010. About 646 functions in 2010, 937 in CU1, 944 in CU2, and there are more coming. Okay, so this will only grow. Eventually, one day, we're going to have a 1,000 commandlet party in Exchange and just go nuts. And probably rewrite OWA in the process. Okay, something else that is new in CU2. This is something, again, that we haven't done a very good job, I think, of talking about this, even though it's a very cool thing. We now, starting with CU2, have this ability to update the help file automatically, and that will include the commandlet updates as well. So this is a really big thing, because for those of you who are used to using commandlet help, if that help isn't updated in a timely manner, then you may be getting out-of-date help. You might be trying to use a parameter that may have been removed from an update, but the help file still refers to it, and commandlet help still refers to it because it hasn't been updated yet. Well, now we've got updatable help. You can actually literally use the update exchange help commandlet. It's got to be an internet-connected server, but it will go down and download any updates for your help, including the commandlet help system, and then you'll have the latest, greatest help right away without having to wait necessarily for the next full update to be released. So that's a big thing, help updates in between cumulative updates. Now let's talk about some tools. Some of these tools we've already talked about, like the sizing process. How many of you were in my sizing session this week? All right, if you weren't and you have to design and deploy Exchange, I would strongly recommend watching that recording, because I'll walk you through the entire process there. And this is basically it boiled down to the most basic part of the process itself. Now, of course, you got to look at the guidance, you got to gather data, you got to determine your requirements, you need to calculate the solution, you need to determine things, and then you need to validate pre-production. Once you've done all that things, you're ready to go into production. It's not as easy as I'm making it sound, though. It is quite involved, especially the data gathering part, because you need to gather actual statistics on your environment. The most important ones that you'll gather are the user profile, the number of messages users send and receive each day, and the average size of those messages. If you don't have that information, that's really going to hinder your ability to do design, because most of the calculations inside our server role calculator, which is the first tool I want to talk about, are predicated upon your entering that information. And that information is going to be unique to your environment, so you can't copy your friend's homework on this one. You really need to go and get the information yourself. I mean, you could copy it, but you're basically designing their system, not yours. Okay, so you really need to go and get your own numbers. How do you do that? Perf counters. We publish tons and tons of perf counters, including perf counters around message activity and message size. So all you really need to do is collect those for a few weeks, maybe a month or so, get yourself a good baseline and a good average, and then use that to enter the information into the calculator. We do have tools if you're running older versions of Exchange. For instance, if you're on Exchange 2007, we've got a tool called the Exchange Profile Analyzer that can go in and get that information. One of the downsides of those tools, using that versus the perf counters, the perf counters are collecting the live data as it's happening. The profile analyzer is only scanning the mailbox contents. So the profile analyzer can be fooled, because if a user's deleting a bunch of their mail, the profile analyzer won't really know how many messages they're truly sending and receiving. So either way, the performance counters are going to be your best bet there. Now, the calculator it is totally different from what we had before. Yes, it still has the same layout, and yes, it's still Excel-based, but we changed the name, and it's doing so much more than anything we ever had before. We're not just doing the mailbox server role, we're also doing the CAS role, so we've got both roles covered. We're also doing storage, and not just guidance on what disks to use and what size to use, but also how to lay them out in a database availability group to avoid failure domains. And we've also included all of these buttons to do things like simulate server failures, so you can see what your load will be in a server outage or a multi-server outage or a WAN outage. You can simulate a WAN failure and see what your load would be on your server design at that point. And then there's also scripts that the calculator can output, PowerShell scripts that you can use to build your DAG and deploy your databases and basically use that as the documentation starting point for your deployment, as the beginning point of your change management process once you transition from pilot into operations. So all of the functionality makes this a must-have tool for all Exchange administrators. Even if you've already designed your solution, you should still familiarize yourself with this tool, because you might have other solutions to design, or you might have to redesign your other solution if you didn't use this tool. Now, we do have feedbacks that we release regularly. This is the latest version. Always use the latest version of the calculator. One of the reasons we do updates is because we find bugs in it, and we want to fix it and make sure that we've got the proper calculations in there. So always use the latest version there. Now, JetStress. This is another must-have tool. After you've used the calculator and you've determined what your storage requirements are, then you can get that storage from your vendor, configure it, set it up the way your storage vendor recommends, and most of the common storage vendors that are used today are well-versed in Exchange deployments. We work with many of them, particularly with our Exchange Solution Reviewed program for storage vendors. And so just about any storage vendor you will use today will know how to appropriately tune and configure their storage subsystem specifically for Exchange and for Exchange 2013. So follow your storage guidance, your storage vendor's guidance on that, but always use JetStress to validate. And of course, remember, JetStress is a pre-production validation tool. You do this before you have any users on the box. Okay, you don't deploy any users. This is a clean system. All you've done is built it, and now you're validating it with JetStress. Because JetStress is going to, as its name implies, stress your databases, your Jet databases, with I/O activity to figure out if that storage subsystem provides you with the IOPS that you need. So it's always pre-production, and there's always some cleanup work that you have to do after you're running it as well. The documentation that comes with JetStress now, or the field guide as we call it, that is the full documentation for JetStress. So we don't have a separate help file for it like we did before. It's now all in that one field guide for you. Now, the Exchange Deployment Assistant, I showed a little bit of this in one of my earlier sessions this week. This continues the work we did in Exchange 2010 to develop a web-based tool where all you need to do is just answer a few questions about your deployment, and then the tool will give you instructions step-by-step on how to do the actual deployment. It will literally walk you through the install process, the configuration process, and each of the steps also has a validation process as well. So before you continue with the next step, you can always follow the instructions for validating that your prior task succeeded successfully and you're ready to go on. Okay, so check out the deployment assistant. We are constantly working to update that as well to make it better and better. Also, the Remote Connectivity Analyzer, and this is one of those tools that, you know, started with Exchange and then grew well out of Exchange to include things like OCS and Link and Office 365 and all sorts of SMTP tests and so forth. So this is the tool that was originally designed to give Exchange on-premises administrators the ability to test external connectivity of their servers without having to leave the office. So think about it. I'm an Exchange 2010 administrator. I've just installed CAS. I've configured my firewall, and I'm ready to verify connectivity. But typically in that scenario, it wouldn't be until the administrator went home that night, and then they could try to connect in remotely, because it's hard to connect remotely when you're actually inside the corporate network. So what we did in Exchange, we had some developers come up in, actually in our product quality department, they came up with this idea of having an external web service-based solution where customers could go and put in some information about a mailbox and their domain and whatnot, and we would simulate that user activity externally against their infrastructure. And so if we had a problem like resolving DNS or getting through the firewall or a problem with a certificate or auto-discover or anything like that, the tool would tell them about it, and it would also give them instructions on how to fix the problem as well. So it's a fantastic tool. Now, in addition to having this web service that we have that runs out of a Microsoft data center, we also have a downloadable version of it now as well. So you can actually download this and run it on your own systems and use that to test connectivity both internally and externally. And this, again, this tool suite has tons and tons of different tests. Auto-discover, Outlook Anywhere, SMTP inbound and outbound, certificate tests, Office 365 single sign-on, link tests, OCS tests. It's just fantastic in terms of its diagnostic abilities. It also now has this brand new functionality called Message Analyzer. You take the SMTP headers from a message, either from Outlook or some other mechanism, and you paste them into this tool, and it very quickly analyzes them by showing you all the different hops and how long it took to go through each hop and any other things that are noteworthy that are found in the message headers. So you don't have to like pour through all that stuff, which if you've sent messages in and out of Office 365, you can see those headers are quite long because of all the hops that we go through and all the hygiene that we do on the message. This cuts through all that and lets you very quickly analyze what's going on with that message from the headers itself. And then there's a separate new version of just the message analyzer itself that's now in beta that you can go and you can download from the Connect website and start using that as well. It's very fast and it's very super easy to use. You literally just copy the headers and you just paste it into the tool itself, into just the main window, and it will do the analysis and show you every hop and give you all the information that I just described. Oh, and it is compatible with 8.1, so any of you who've moved forward, it's now up to date for 8.1 as well. There's also an Outlook connectivity tool for Office 365, and I mention it not just because it's great for cloud users, but believe it or not, it's also absolutely useful for on-premises users as well. So on-premises admins can also use the same tool to troubleshoot problems like Outlook repeatedly prompting for credentials, Outlook not connecting to my folders, and other Outlook connectivity issues. So this is a fantastic tool for diagnosing Outlook connection problems. We do design it and promote it as a tool that can be used for Office 365, but again, it works great for on-premises as well. The Exchange Server 2003 Management Pack, how many of you are running System Center Operations Manager? All right, and how many of you are using that to monitor Exchange? Okay, well, so here's the thing with that. Monitoring has also changed considerably in Exchange 2013. The old paradigm, the old mindset of using SCUM to do things like perform root cause analysis or diagnosis or even corrective action as an externally deployed application are gone. That is not the approach that we take anymore. And the reason for that is after running large-scale cloud-based services for several years now, you know, almost 8 years in terms of some form of Exchange in the cloud, and using System Center, we found that, first of all, that it doesn't really work at the scale that we needed to. So that was one challenge. Just to scale the System Center infrastructure to meet the scale of Exchange did not work for us, and it was non-economical. But the other problem is this chasing root cause analysis and correlation of problems, you don't get anything out of that. What we found is we had to make tons and tons of customizations inside our own System Center deployments, and none of that development work ever accrued to an on-premise customer. It was all done in a vacuum in our own little world, and no one else got any benefits from that. So what we decided to do instead was take a new approach with Exchange 2013, and that is in fact why managed availability was born. We decided that it didn't really make sense to have external monitoring because now that was another dependency that could potentially affect our high availability. So we decided to make all of our monitoring in Exchange be internal. And that is effectively what managed availability is, except that it's more than just monitoring. It's also recovery oriented. It has the ability through what we call responders to take corrective action. Okay, and I'll talk about that, and I'll show you how you can figure out what managed availability is doing in a minute. But basically, it changes the way we use System Center. System Center now becomes an escalation and alerting portal, not our monitoring and recovery engine. Okay? So what we mean by that is if there's a problem managed availability cannot fix, it will escalate that to a human. It does that through event logs. Once those event logs go to System Center, they become alerts for System Center. That's all they are. So System Center becomes an alerting portal, and it also feeds into the health views that we give you of managed availability. That would be an organizational health view, a server health view, a component health view, and so forth. So System Center is really just a view of the health as a system and an alerting portal. That is the extent to which we'll use it to monitor Exchange. So when you're using the Exchange 2013 management pack, that management pack is simply there to connect System Center with the information it's getting from managed availability. So it's a very, very different approach. Now, those of you who listened very carefully to what I just said, you caught the fact that I said our escalation is through event log notification. So what that means is, no, you don't need to be using System Center. Any third-party tool that can collect event logs and notify an administrator about certain events can be used for that purpose. So if you already have a monitoring solution, you can use it to get escalations from managed availability as well. What you don't get is the value add that System Center provides, though, in that alerting portal that shows you the organizational health. Viewing that health at a glance is a very powerful thing to do because it's either going to be green or red, and if it's red, you can literally double-click it to drill down into what the health of, of the whole system is and actually find that one specific component that is unhealthy and why it's unhealthy. So it's a great, quick and easy way to figure out what's actually wrong if you have System Center. All right. The Office Configuration Analyzer tool. This is another great tool for finding what we consider to be common configuration configuration problems with things like an Outlook profile or other Office applications. So if you, you're starting up an application in Office and it crashes or it stops or something, or you're trying to start up Outlook and it's giving you a problem with your profile, this tool will go in here and help you determine whether or not there are any common configuration issues that need to be fixed. So it will help you do that. It also replaces the old OCAT tool that we had, the Outlook Configuration Analyzer tool. Basically, OCAT got expanded into OffCAT, so it could include Excel, Access, PowerPoint, and Word as well. So this will scan the deployment, and if there's any problems, missing files, things like that, it will tell you about it. And then for those of you who have very, very large infrastructures, and you want a fast way to deploy, really the best way is to engage Microsoft Consulting Services because the Exchange Product Group has worked with them to create a set of intellectual property documents, which is basically an architecture reference document or a starting basis for a deployment called the Product Line Architecture, or PLA. Other product groups have this as well. Link has it, and other groups have them as well. And basically what it is when you engage with an MCS consultant at Microsoft, they will come with this packaged up. And so they will have basically a design, a reference architecture for you to start with. And that reference architecture is an encoding of all of our best practices for deploying Exchange in a large-scale enterprise environment. So it's going to promote our high availability story. It's going to recommend multiple databases for volume. It's going to recommend using JBOD. It's going to recommend all the best practices around virtualization and around database availability groups. And it's basically the fastest way for a large enterprise to get deployed. I want to almost describe it as cookie cutter, but I don't want you to think it's cookie cutter because it's really not. It can be tailored to your organization, but it is really the starting point for the discussions. And assuming you can adhere to all our best practices, then it probably will be very close to the deployment that you deploy. But there may be things that your company can't do for whatever reason. For example, one of our best practices is to use split DNS so that you can minimize the number of host names. Not all customers can do that. In fact, a lot of universities, particularly in the United States, they just use public DNS. That's all they use. They don't use any internal DNS, and so they can't use split DNS. So when we're designing for them, we would overwrite the rule that says, okay, we can't use split DNS, but we can still deploy everything else in a best practice fashion. So you do have the flexibility to tailor this to your needs, but it does give you that starting point reference architecture that gets you going and really gets the conversation going. Now, This is brand new. We're announcing it. I think we just announced it 6 hours ago, literally, and I still managed to get it in here for you. Yes. Okay, Office 365 Best Practices Analyzer for Exchange 2013. Okay, it's out there. You can go and download it now. You do have to sign in with an Office 365 user ID. But once you do that, that gets you the tool, and then you won't have to sign in again to run your tests or anything. Or an Azure Active Directory user ID can do it as well. So you can go to that website, sign in with one of those IDs, and then you can download it. And even though, despite its name, it says Office 365 Best Practices Analyzer, but it can be used for on-premises only. So if you're using 2013 on-premises, you can use that for your environment. You can also use it for hybrid. And of course, Office 365 customers who are just using Exchange Online can also use this new tool as well. So I know there was a question in one of my sessions, I think yesterday or maybe the day before, about the best practices analyzer. And I couldn't really answer that at that time because we hadn't announced it yet. But here's your answer now if you're in the room. Yay, it's out. BPA's back. Yay. OK, let's talk about IW and calendaring. Take a quick check of the time. Okay, so I mentioned some of the things that we did for Outlook Web App. We have completely rewritten Outlook Web App, and believe it or not, there's a pretty good reason that we keep doing this. We keep doing this because we always want to be relevant and current on the latest browsers and the latest devices. So we have, in fact, rewritten Outlook Web App in 2013 specifically so that we could embrace and engage with all these new different devices and different screens and different form factors that are available. So what we have now is the ability in Outlook Web App to dynamically or statically, manually, if you want to do it that way, change the view of Outlook Web App based on the device that you're using. If you're using a desktop computer, we will give you a desktop view. If you're using a tablet, we will give you a tablet view. And if you're using a phone, we will give you a phone view. Okay? And you can actually change the view on the fly. So the tablet view is T-wide, the phone view is T-narrow, desktop is the default view, but you can actually just pass this on, this question mark layout, and then equals one of these two, and put that in the OWA URL after you're signed in, and it will dynamically refresh and rewrite into that new view. So you can, if you want to demo this for people, you can change from desktop to T-wide to T-narrow and back and forth in any combination without having to sign out and sign back in. Once you're signed in and in your mailbox, just add that question mark layout equals whatever at the end, and it will dynamically change the view once you press enter. It's very cool. It's very easy to manage. Keep in mind, though, once you're in that T-wide view, you don't have folder management handy. You actually have to expand the view through touch or through a mouse to go ahead and see your folder tree available. The idea here is we are optimizing the screen real estate based on the device that we interpret that you're using. There is a large number of browsers and devices that are supported, but just be aware, if we can't determine what you're running on, we will simply default you to the default view, which ends up looking a lot like the light version of Outlook Web App, if you've seen that before. Now, calendaring. We've done a lot of work around calendaring, and much of it has to also do with the fact that there's all these new devices that can now manipulate calendar items as well. So some of the more important changes, we have dropped the logging down a little bit. We used to save the calendar logs for 120 days, but now we only save them for much less than that, I think 31 days. And we do that, we reduce that simply because we never needed that. We didn't need, you know, 4 months of calendar data when we were doing diagnostics. Going back, you know, a month is pretty good amount of data to have to sift through and analyze. The other thing that we've done is you do have a calendar logging quota that you can set as well. And so we do give the ability to sort of control how much logging can occur on the system as well. And you can actually use the get calendar diagnostic log analysis commandlet to analyze the log files themselves. So you don't have to do anything fancier than run a commandlet to get analysis of what's going on. So why is logging important? Because it includes all the information about what user accessed an item and what they did with it and when they did it and from what device and what happened after they did it and so forth. So here's a real-world example of how we actually used calendar logging in 2013 to help an executive figure out what happened in a meeting. So an executive at, I'm not going to mention the company, you probably won't even hear of it, wouldn't have heard of it anyway, but executive showed up in a meeting. And they were the only one there, and they were really curious as to why that is. You don't want to have executives showing up in meetings when no one's there. That's a huge waste of their time, and they hate that. And so they contacted the help desk, and then they worked with us to gather information. So what we did is we collected the calendar logs. And when you're doing this kind of diagnostics and you're getting a report from an admin that says one person went to a meeting and no one was there, but there were all these other people, there was a different organizer, and there were all these other attendees that were supposed to be there. So what you want to do is you want to collect the data from the calendar organizer and from one other attendee, not the executive, but some other attendee, just to match the information, see if these things reconcile with what the other executive's calendar says. So then we run an analysis on the logs, okay, using that commandlet that I talked about. And when we did this, here's what we found. The executive used some device to edit a meeting, and when they did that, they caused the whole entire series to be deleted. And that, of course, removed that from everybody else's calendar, but kept it on the executive calendar because they had a unique edited copy of it. And so everybody else didn't know about the meeting anymore, except for the executive, which had their own strange version of that meeting. And so they went, and they were the only ones alone. But using the built-in native calendar logging and the diagnostics commandlet, we were able to show exactly what happened and why this event occurred. So this is very, very powerful logging information that we have here. We've also done work around, I will save time for questions at the end. We've also done work around the calendar repair assistant as well. So we've made it much more effective. If you're not familiar with this, the calendar repair assistant compares organizer and attendee meeting information and reconciles it. So for instance, if you've accepted a meeting request, but for some reason it's not showing up on your calendar, the CRA can come in and fix that for you behind the scenes. So it tries to fix up calendar problems without getting humans involved. And we do have improved logging as well. So if you do need to do some manual fixing of calendar entries, you can use the built-in logging information to help you figure out which items are messed up and what needs to be corrected. Now let's talk a little bit about transport. The one thing I wanted to point about transport is this new concept and this new property that we've introduced in the transport queues called queue velocity. It's our way of measuring how fast your queues are draining. So you can see queue velocity, it's either going to be a zero or a one, it's either going to be a zero value or a negative value. It will never be a positive value. Zero basically means your queue is emptying as fast as messages are coming in. Any negative value means that messages are coming in faster than they're leaving the queue. Obviously, you can't have a positive value. You can't have messages leaving faster than they're coming in. That's just not possible. But when you're looking at this, and I'll show you what it looks like in a minute, when you're looking at the queue velocity, though, you also have to factor in message count, because you could have a very low message count, and if you have a negative queue velocity, there's some sort of problem there. But if you have a very high message count and a negative queue velocity, that's not a problem. You might just have a very busy queue with a lot of messages that need to go through. So you can use get queue to see the queue velocity. We just call it velocity here, and we show you a separate velocity for each of the queues that are present on that specific server. So as we're looking in these right here, I can see on my server EX1, I've got a velocity of zero of all these. Again, that means messages are leaving the queue as fast as they are coming in. But on some of these queues, on EX2, I've got a negative value. Some messages are not leaving as fast as they're coming in. The queue is building up, in other words. But here, we want you to also look at message count as well, because the message count is going to be used to correlate whether or not that should be an expected number. Again, if this is a very large number, then you might expect a negative queue velocity for that time period as it's trying to process and drain the queue. But if this is a very small number and you still have a negative queue velocity, then you might want to look a little deeper. Maybe it's a small number, but they're very, very large messages, and that's why you've got a negative queue velocity. Maybe someone decided to send like a video or a CAD drawing or some ridiculously large ripped DVD or something like that, and now there's just one message in the queue, but your queue velocity is just going down and down and down because of that. So keep in mind, you got to look a little deeper sometimes, but at a glance, we give you pretty good information now as to how fast your queues are draining. Now, one thing about getq, though, that's another one of those commandlets that doesn't have 100% backward compatibility. So it's only going to work with 2010 and 2013. It doesn't work with 2007. If you're running 2007 with 2013, you'll simply use the q viewer in 2007 to view the queues in 2007. And of course, the queue velocity is only for 2013. You won't see queue velocity for 2007, obviously. Now, queue logging is also enabled, and it cannot be turned off by default. So keep that in mind. There's a lot of extra diagnostic logging that goes on with Exchange. This is just one example in one area, but there's tons and tons of other areas where we log a whole bunch of stuff. And you can actually go in here, because this includes tons and tons of great messages in here, or great pieces of information in there, like what the hops were, what the incoming and outgoing rate of the queue was at that time. So you could see, as you're looking at that entry, how fast was the queue performing at that time. You can also look at things like the TLS domain, any errors that occurred, and then any information about the data itself. One thing that I'll point out, this is what a typical queue entry looks like here. You can see we call it queue, we give you the name of the server. You can see it's in a retry state, and it's in a retry state because the DNS connector delivery for contoso.com, it was not able to find that address. You can see the error message here, 4.2.1, unable to connect, and then the rest of the error message, attempted failover E. Okay? That is not a typo. Failover E is the end of the log. Why? Because for whatever reason, some random reason, the developer who did this decided to limit that logging to 54 characters. So you get 54 characters and no more. So here, the E was our 54th character. I put that quote in there. This was our 54th character right here. Now, that having been said, 54 characters is a lot of information here. We can see this, and we can see that the IP address that was responding was basically telling us that I couldn't find any MX record for contoso.com, and so I'm in a retry state because DNS isn't telling me where to send this message. So we don't even need to see the rest of the error message that's cut off, because we can tell what's going on from here. And of course, we could go and do retry and try to push that forward if we wanted to. All right, let's talk about search, discovery, and compliance a little bit here. In terms of search, things have changed a bit. Now, there's two different ways that you can get search filters inside of Exchange 2013. One is through the Office filter packs, and the second is simply the native functionality that we include with Search Foundation. So Search Foundation, because it's built into Exchange, automatically includes most of the common I filters that you'll need. But the Office filter packs have a couple extra ones. They add support for OneNote and Publisher files for indexing as they go through transport. If you need that functionality, you need the Office filter packs installed as well. If you don't need that functionality, then you can get away with just the native Search Foundation filter stuff. You wouldn't need to separately install the Office filter packs. Now, because setup has the Office filter packs as a prerequisite, if they're not installed, it will generate a warning. Warnings are things that you want to be aware of when setup runs, but they don't block you from running setup. So if you see the warning, but you don't plan on needing the functionality from OFP, then simply ignore the warning and proceed with your setup. But because setup does want them, and because it does generate a warning, we do have to document in the documentation that it is a prerequisite for Exchange. But it's not a hard blocking prerequisite. So if you don't install it, it's not going to break Exchange. It's not going to kill content indexing. You just won't have support for OneNote and Publisher files. In transport, I should say. You'll have support for OneNote and Publisher files in Mailbox, but you won't have support for them in transport. Now, the search. So there are some cases where even if everything is running fine, that search will not do the indexing. And that's typically because there are caps that we put on search for it to do its work. So there's caps around the maximum number of attachments that can be on a message. There's caps around the maximum depth of attachments. So that could be a message within a message within a message, for example. There's also processing images is off by default, and then this is also off by default as well. You may need to go in and change some of those settings. If you have folks sending a lot of nested messages within nested messages, or grabbing messages and attaching them to other messages and sending them off, or if you regularly have applications that send lots and lots of attachments, you might need to go into the registry and adjust those default settings. And again, those would be an example of the default settings that you would want to have scripted and documented in your change management, because when you install a cumulative update, it will set those values back to the out-of-box settings. Now, Search Foundation, like the store and like some other functions, like managed availability, also uses a worker process model. So there is a controller process, that's the search.service .exe, and then there's the host controller service. Now, you'll also see this node runner.exe executable. In fact, you'll see four of them on every running Exchange server. These node runners are basically elements of the Search Foundation code itself. And there's four different nodes, as they call them. One is the administrative interface. That's the process that provides the admin interface into Search Foundation. One is for the content interface. That's the one that accepts the content stream and does content transformation. The third one is the indexing. That's the process responsible for carrying out indexing. And the fourth one is query, and that's the one that's responsible for executing the queries that go against the index. But when you see them running in Task Manager, they're all called noderunner.exe. So how do you know what's what? Well, to do that, simply turn on the command line column view in Task Manager, and that will show you the full command line that gets executed when that process is instantiated. And so for the admin node, most of these names are easily describable. For the admin node, you'll see that it's admin node 1 that is in the path. Content node is content engine node 1, index node is index node 1, and query is the interaction engine node 1. The actual querying component of Search Foundation is called the Interaction Management System, or IMS, so that's where that comes from. All right, I'm not going to go through this chart, but I wanted to include it in there because Search Foundation does use a new querying language, so you're not using the same exactly the same search as you used before. Now you're using keyword querying language, and so here's a little handy cheat sheet for you to be able to learn how to do those things. All right, modern public folders. How are we doing on time? Looks like we're still okay. All right, modern public folders. So as I mentioned, modern public folders are mailbox-based now. There is no public folder replication, but we do still have a process where we do replicate the public folder hierarchy, you know, the tree of folders, to all public folder mailboxes inside the organization. To do that now, we use incremental change synchronization so that anytime a change is made, that gets flagged, and then depending on whether or not users are connected at that time, it'll get replicated either within 15 minutes or within 24 hours, and then replicated right away as soon as that change is discovered. And so that's how we keep the hierarchy consistent across all of the mailboxes. But of course, the content itself will live in only one mailbox. The reason we replicate the hierarchy to all the mailboxes is so that any public folder mailbox that a user connects to should have an up-to-date copy of the hierarchy so that we can display the folders very quickly for them. When they select a folder, then they'll be going to that one public folder mailbox that has the content located in it. Now, there are some limitations. If you move forward to modern public folders, it is a cutover migration. You do have the ability to roll back to legacy public folders, but it can be difficult. The reason for that, as a cutover migration, the legacy public folders get locked, and the modern public folders is where all your new data is now being generated. If you want to roll back, you're basically taking that data and exporting it out of the system, unlocking the legacy public folders, which will basically be in the state at which they were when you locked it, and then you'll have to import that data back in to go back. If you don't do it right, you could lose some of the data that you created in the modern public folders, and we don't want that to happen. So if you're nervous about rolling back, but you really want to do that, you might want to call support for a little hand-holding on that. Some other limits, they do use mailboxes, but they're not exactly like a user mailbox. We can't, for example, use some of the import or export commandlets or use the mailbox restore commandlets against them because of their slight differences from a mailbox. You can search through a public folder, but that's a manual Outlook search. When we say that the contents are not indexable or searchable here, we mean by Search Foundation as part of the overall database based content index. They won't be in there, which means you cannot do e-discovery against modern public folders as well, so keep that in mind. You also cannot apply retention policies. You don't have cross-forest migration, so we can only migrate public folders within a single forest. And that get public folder statistics commandlet that we had is still in there, but it doesn't provide the same information anymore, so keep that in mind. Now, here's some quick commandlets to get you familiar with managing public folders, how to figure out if it's got an up-to-date hierarchy, how to list only those public folders that have content, which is very important if you want to sort of clean house and find out where all the empty folders are. That's a great way to do that. Here's how you can move public folder databases, or public folder content between mailboxes, rather. Keep in mind a couple important things about moving public folder content, though. So for one thing, I'm using the new public folder move request, and I'm passing the folder switch, and I have to list each folder I want. So if a folder like child 1 is a child of a folder like folder 1, and I want to move both the parent and the child, I have to explicitly state both. It won't just move all the children with the parent. So if you say just move the parent, it just moves the parent and all the children stay put. If you want the parent and the child to move, you have to list each folder out separately. Again, you'll list them in quotes and separate them with a comma. And then there's only one move request that's allowed to exist at any given time. So if you are moving a bunch of content because maybe one of your public folder mailboxes got too large and you want to spread the content out to other public folder mailboxes, you'll have to wait for that request to complete. And once it's completed, then you can go ahead and do another move after that. One other thing to keep in mind with public folders is legacy public folders and modern public folders cannot coexist. Again, that's one of the reasons it's a cutover migration. So you may have mail-enabled public folders in your environment, and in that case, when you do this cutover migration, your legacy folders are locked, but your modern public folders aren't open for business yet. And messages coming into your mail-enabled public folders end up getting stuck in the queue. And you actually won't be able to do anything with those messages until you open your modern public folders up for business. Once you do that, then you can go ahead and do a stop and start of the transport service, and that will automatically redirect all of the messages from that queue and send them over to the modern public folders. When you do the cutover migration, the mail enableness of the public folder will go with it. But those messages will get stuck until the migration is done, and you just need to restart transport, and they'll get unstuck and move over to the new public folders. And then you'll also see that message redirection logged in the message tracking logs as well. So you'll see that behavior happening. All right, and then the last thing I wanted to talk about was for public folders was how to recover a deleted modern public folder as well. And this is a fairly simple process. You just do set public folder, and then you change the path. This is where we store the deleted stuffs. Give it the folder name, and you give it the name of the parent folder that you wanted to talk about. All right, the last area that we're going to go through, and I know we're getting a little short on time, so we might go a little quick, is the managed availability stuff. So I talked a lot about what managed availability is. These are the commandlets that you'll use to basically manage it. The two primary ones would be get health report and get server health. There's other ones in there that you would use to do other things as well. And I don't want to talk about too much about get health report and get server health, because what I really wanted to do was talk about how you figure out what managed availability is doing on your box. So whenever managed availability takes some form of recovery action, whether it is successful or not, it will log that recovery action in this crimson channel, the microsoft.exchange.managedavailability/recovery-actions. Now, the event 501 indicates that some form of recovery action has started. A 502 indicates that the recovery action completed successfully. And a 501 does that, and then a 502 indicates that a recovery action completed unsuccessfully. Okay? So a recovery action could be something like cycling the IIS worker pool, if it's an IIS-related thing, or maybe even stopping and restarting a service like IIS or one of the other exchange services, or maybe failing over databases or failing over a server, or it might be intentionally bug-checking the server to cause just a server-wide failover as well. But either way, whatever managed availability ends up doing, it logs it into that crimson channel. So How can you get it? Well, obviously you can go into the event viewer and read these events one by one by one, but I prefer to use PowerShell to do that. So in this first command, what we're doing is we're assigning an alias called recovery action results, and we're just using the get win event PowerShell commandlet that comes in Windows, passing the computer name, and we're getting all the logs from that recovery action results. Now, you can use that native format that commandlet will output it, but in the service and in production, you're going to find it a lot easier to just put it into PowerShell's native XML format. So that is what this second commandlet does. It basically takes the output from the first one and puts it into PowerShell's native XML format so that it can be searched and transformed a little bit easier. There's a bunch of information that will be in there. This is your sort of your legend, if you will, for the information that you're going to see in there. And so basically what you do is, let's just say we had a problem where I noticed that the replication service got started restarted by managed availability. So we're going to take that same alias, the XML alias, and we're going to look for something that says it was finished with a resource name of MS Exchange REPL. I want to find out why the replication service was started, and I'm looking for the word finished because that tells me when the restart action was finished. And then I've got an output time, and I end up with basically something that looks like this. The time at which the event happened, the time at which the service was restarted, and then the requester is the internal component name that actually requested that service be restarted. So we want to drill down. We're actually working the problem backwards. We know that it restarted, and now we figured out what requester it restarted. But we still need to work the problem back. Remember that managed availability uses probes, monitors, and responders. Probes collect the data, they feed the data to the monitors, and then the monitors end up invoking a responder to trigger the recovery. So now that we know the responder that triggered the recovery, we want to work it back and find out what monitor triggered that. So to do that, we want to get the responder definitions, and we can do that with this alias, define responders. Every time the managed availability health service starts up, we automatically define all of the probes and monitors and responders inside the event log. So what we're doing now is we're actually getting those responder definitions, and we're actually looking specifically for the responder that we saw in the previous slide. So see that long requester name? That's the responder that we're looking for. So we're getting that here from the defined responder. We're getting a list of all the responders, and now we're just asking for, tell us which one that is, and give us the alert mask. And the alert mask in this case is the name of the monitor that triggered that responder. Okay, so now we're still working back. We know what triggered the recovery. We know what told it to trigger the recovery. Now we need to work back to the probe to find out the error message that the probe encountered that started this whole process in the first place. So now that we know what the monitor is, we can go ahead and get all the monitor definitions, and then we can look at the probe definition event log. Again, the probes get logged in there at startup, just like the monitors and responders. And we're looking for one that has the Service Exchange or Service Health MS Exchange REPL Endpoint Probe. And again, that was the one that we had back down here, REPL Endpoint Monitor, and now we're looking for the REPL Endpoint Probe. And when we get that, we end up with these three different probes. There's an endpoint probe looking for the server locator. There's an endpoint probe looking for the RPC service. And there's an endpoint probe looking for the TCP socket as well. All of those are targeting the replication service. So we're looking at all those endpoints within the replication service. That is what this probe is designed to do. And when this probe decided to check on those services for the replication service, it found that there were some errors that it encountered. How do we figure out what the errors are? Again, we're going looking for that service health MS Exchange REPL endpoint probe, and we're getting the probe results, and we're basically looking at things like the time, the result, the error, and some other information. The other thing that we're doing is we're also passing that, or piping it rather, to out in a grid view to make it easier to display. So what we actually end up with is this. This is the resulting output of that last commandlet. So we can see, as I mentioned, the time that was here, the result name, and look, here's the error column showing us the message. So as an example, the monitoring tasks RPC listener threw an exception. Okay, so we know the RPC listener did not respond. And here it is checking it again, and we can see that it also did not respond. So the error was that the endpoints we tried to connect to simply did not respond. That led managed availability to realize that the service wasn't running, and so that's why managed availability started that service. The probe found the errors, passed that to the monitors, and the monitors invoked the responders that restarted the service for me automatically. One last thing to say about managed availability. A lot of the work it does involves probes that send SMTP messages to verify that mail flow is occurring properly. And as a result of that, if you happen to be using journaling because there are messages that are being sent through the system, managed availability messages may start to fill up your journal mailbox. And that's probably something that you don't want to happen because you don't need to journal these messages. They're just meant as internal only probes for the system to verify health flow. So to prevent that from happening, there's one of two things you can do. You can use global journaling, which doesn't have that side effect, but you can also create what we call an override. Managed availability gives you the capability of overriding its functions. Now, you cannot configure what it does, but you can tell it not to do certain things. So as an example, using that KB would show you how to create an override that would prevent those messages from going into the journal mailbox, as one example. All right, I think I've got like 30 seconds left. I was hoping to have time for questions, but I will make time outside in the hallway. I'll get off the stage so the next presenter can set up, and I will be happy to take your questions. If you don't have any now, feel free to ping me at any time. There's my contact info. And if you don't already have an Exchange poster, calmly and casually make your way up, and hopefully you can get one. Thanks very much for coming, and enjoy the rest of the show.